Drama on One.
Sundays at 8 p.m.
rte.ie/drama on one.
Drama on One.
You're listening to RTE Radio 1. Drama on One is offered as a podcast at rte.ie/drama on one and of course here on RTE Radio 1 on Sunday nights. This week on Drama on One, we remember Judith Mock, the Dutch soprano, writer and vocal coach, who died in November of last year. When COVID-19 was locking us in, Judith sang from her Dublin balcony, delighting the passers-by. That voice had been heard in concert halls around the world, on stages she shared with the London Sinfonietta, the Vienna Symphony and others, in works by Mozart, Puccini, Bob Zimmerman and Tan Dunn. As you'll hear, she wrote beautifully, publishing poetry and fiction in Dutch and English, and in 2022 she published her powerful memoir, The State of Dark. Judith was also a gifted vocal coach, her students including Grace Jones, Radiohead's Tom York, The Frames' Glenn Hansard and Soda Blonde's Faye O'Rourke. She'll be remembered by a huge community of friends for her consummate artistry, her warmth and sparkling intelligence, and deeply missed by her beloved family. On our National Holocaust Memorial Day, we'll hear Judith perform her radio memoir, Confinements, which was recorded in 2021 during the pandemic. Recurring lockdowns prompt echoes from her family history, of precious moments together and of lives lost in the darkest days of World War II. These histories crisscross with Judith's recordings as a soprano, including her singing of the piece Zay, described by composer Jeff Hamburg as a lament for a culture that had almost been wiped out. This is Confinements by Judith Mock.
It could be a fairy tale, the soaring line of the violin added to the song line I had to follow and fly with the song and the entire chaos of a tuning orchestra to then find this rich balance of harmonies, of music that was carrying me, that was written for me by the composer Jeff Hamburg, a score enabling me to fill it in with my voice, letting the words of Judah Halevi soar through the grand hall of the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam to take the public with me in this tale of sound. Bring me there unharmed and then fly back again, a memory of passionate musicians playing around me, a black and gold dress that hugged me in the spotlights. Give greetings to all my loved ones and tell them of my happiness. I remember in my Dublin confinement how I sang those lines in Yiddish. And now I know how lucky I am that I can sing here when they, my parents, who just happened to be Jews, suffered their confinement with the perpetual threat of death at their door. All songs had gone during World War II and the Nazi occupation of Holland, where I'm from. My father was persecuted by the Nazis in the Netherlands because he was a Jew. That was the only reason. He had to go into hiding, total confinement, so to say. Good people would risk their lives, hiding Jews under floorboards, in attics or secret rooms. My father shared his first hiding place with six other people. Among them was a well-brought-up creature, a lady who came from Berlin with a suitcase full of Berlin airs and graces, according to my father. Those six people in confinement were lucky enough to eat together. The good people who hid them cooked for them. And it thus seemed there happened to be salad, green salad, served with every meal. My father would, reluctantly, eat his greens and then proceed to eat his meal. But Hannah, the Berlinerin, would have none of it. Every meal she scolded him in neat German. Den Salat isst man bekanntlich zuletzt. It is a well-known fact that one finishes one's meal with salad. To which my father, highly irritated in these heightened circumstances of fear, would add that he clearly was a goat and needed to devour his greens right away. They were all safe eating their salad at that moment, with nowhere to go, of course. Tracks. Not the obvious ones that ended in nowhere, in death. I find that a strange expression, the wrong side of the tracks. To me, there is just that one beside the trains that took them to the extermination camps. The familiar ones are taking you to the mountains, to the sea, drawing lines through lavender fields. Then there were the tracks in 1945 Germany, children begging along those tracks, the only thing left to them to follow and find a future. They glued their cracked little hands to windows of the trains carrying the sick from Holland to Switzerland. My mother, she was on one of those trains, leaned out of her bed and out of the window to give her food away to German children. Children on the wrong side of the tracks who were hungry, and she was too, but she couldn't digest any food anymore after a long winter of starvation. She imagined she could hear the little stomachs tight as drums, rumble and rumble. Fear and starvation have their own rhythm. They beat an inner drum, one that can be heard in your own ears only. We sit with winter still at our windows, our feet by the stove, and we watch the colored pictures, children in bombed-out Syria, seeking food in rubbish heaps looking like massive toy mountains. So much can be found there. They do find stuff and bring their exotic bounty back to the streets of a burned-out city. Into a night, they go, singing. I saw them in a documentary that choked me into silence. Syrian children, Yemenites, Africans plagued by just another plague. One COVID-19, not high on their list, I'd say. But they must be higher on our list somehow, those children. I know a happy Syrian girl who sings to me in her Dublin confinement, dressed in her best dress. She tries to teach me Arabic. I might learn. Sing it to me. Ranim's daughter, Serena, sings to me. German is what you were born in, Anna. Then, when you went to a Dutch school, you started learning the language of the Amsterdammers, with a lot of distorted Yiddish and even Hebrew, in a common speak, so to say. Mokum is the term for Amsterdam, meaning the place of refuge in your case, is Amsterdam. The Mayim is the water, i.e. the canal. Your house, your family's hiding place, is on one of these canals. Your family and the other family you were with spoke German originally, and yet it was branded the evil language by everybody in that place of hiding. And you were all communicating in Dutch, the language I was born in. I can imagine the almost comical accents the older people must have had, or even their turn of phrase. Something like the German Jewish couple who were in the film Casablanca, who fled their country and were practicing for their new life in the USA. "What o'clock is it, darling?" they asked each other. And then, here I am locked in a gentle confinement, overlooking the Mayim, my canal, and the immense spread of the Dublin mountains. Locked into the English language for 20 years now, leaving my native Dutch for occasional whispers to my husband, who did learn Dutch while living in Mokum, i.e. Amsterdam. Dutch is not an evil language to me. It just feels awkwardly inadequate if I want to express myself with hopefully more simplicity. English is my hiding place. It is where I find words in the strangest places that are unpronounceable and inexplicable to me. So I search in the attics and salons of my hiding place for the meaning of these words or expressions that are stashed away, and I collect them, I savor them like a gift, a toy of letters I'm allowed to maybe play with. Anne Frank, you wrote down your life in confinement in Dutch. You must have heard the adults occasionally revert to their own habitat, their original German, translating their despair and fear and anger back into their own language. This is a different type of confinement. To exclude yourself from your own language Was it to stifle their innermost expression of fear? I'm asking you these questions as if you were here, because you became part of my life, Anna, when your father rang our doorbell by the dunes near the North Sea. On a quiet afternoon, I must have been 5 or 6 at the time. We were sitting in the living room and our mother was talking about varnishing the floorboards in a deep purple. Strange that I can remember words that were spoken then. So, deep purple, Anna. And your father stood there. Otto Frank had come from Switzerland to Holland, many years after the end of World War II. He was seemingly still coming across papers that needed handling, like those letters written to my father from his sister, Sire, shortly before her death in Bergen-Belsen. He handed them to my father. My father was crying. I'd never seen him cry. I'd never seen him cry. That's how you came into my life, Anna, through my father. Through your father, Otto Frank. It was years later that I read your diary, written in my native language. You never held back in that language. Deep courage, raging lust for life in your miserable confinement. How did my aunt's letters come to live in your father's hands? I honestly don't know. You and Sire, my aunt, died together in the camp of Bergen-Belsen. That's all I know. Do you remember the mulberry tree at that Russian poet's place? I once asked, and my mother starts to speak of that mulberry tree. But she also mentions the other similar tree in the south of France, growing in front of the house where we stayed for years. And she was old, and I had become a mother with a daughter and husband. When in the heat of an afternoon we'd all fallen asleep, woman, child, man, as a nearly biblical small family close to the earth, the air, and mother stood over us and said that, Maya radost. And she was her mother, her grandmother, her great-grandmother, all come back to tell us that we were her joy. I sang it to her, my Radost. I heard it being said to the children of the Russian friend, the poet Paul Rodchenko. When we all listened to him playing the balalaika, a beautiful string instrument, folk instrument, like the one played in the famous novel by Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago. I could learn to play it, but I'm not one for the plucking instrument, you know. I like to look at it and hum a song my mother used to sing around the mulberry tree. Moja radost, my joy. I have books, many books to read. I have a book written by the Russian author Nabokov. It is called Ada, and it reminds me of my family at home, long gone already, mixing up the giant pool of European languages to suit themselves. Moja radost, they say it in that book, the two tragic lovers when they find each other after a gap of 10 years in a dark, luxurious nightclub. A day of singing in the mulberry tree. My father had gone quiet. I could feel he was at the beginning of one of his episodes of dark, silent days, in which he wouldn't speak to us. We walked together along the erect houses in a port called Fiere, a seaside town in Zeeland, along the sea, on uneasy cobblestones, the sky shone in that clean, clear light, showing us in the day that there was nothing more to it, to our life, than this. Father and me holding hands, looking at the movement of the North Sea. He made me hop over one bollard to the next. I jumped the chains in between them, until we reached the end of the harbour and stood there with nowhere to go. We didn't speak. Father sighed a vague, yes, and I nodded in agreement. We turned around, and I felt as if this bright and beautiful summer light had wiped out everything and just walked and saw only a blank day around us. I filled in his silence with my own. That is how it started, with me telling this story, with mother, so slender in her cotton dress, sitting under the mulberry tree full of fruit, singing a folk tune, Moja radost, my joy. A long confinement with people that live in my past, feeding it so it grows and takes shape into our hands. Hands dipped in paint when we place them on the pillar in the living room to leave the imprints of our existence. A Kabbalistic habit to prove we were all in the house before our daughter left for New York back then. So, again, memories. We had to leave our home when we were little, Marianne and I. We were to be with other people while our mother was confined to her sick bed. My sister Marianne went to get her childhood painting with Bommel, the dog, and Bello, the steam train, and the loving couple of artists by the sea who painted Marianne's puzzle piece, a piece that became the totem of her stay. We had that painting to share in our bedroom, later back home. But she took it when she went to live elsewhere. It was hers, not mine. I'd been staying with animal lovers somewhere else. But still, our youth was in it, in that painting. Marianne is far away now, living on another island. I'm here, confined in Dublin, watching the city, working with people on screens. My pupils work far away and write beautiful songs for all, to tell us how they are without fear. We cannot touch each other anymore, but I can hug nature, listen to birds and Mozart, stroke the softness out of our pet's fur, and bring out my voice to speak. Bring mir nur dahin, Bescholem. Bring me there, unharmed, to sing. Sing.
You've been listening to Confinements, written and performed by Judith Mock. The programme was recorded in 2021. We've played it again in her memory. You also heard Judith's recordings as a soprano, including the piece Zay, composed by Jeff Hamburg and performed with the new Sinfonietta Amsterdam. Sound design and sound supervision were by Mark Dwyer. Confinements by Judith Mock was produced by Kevin Brew. The series producer of Drama on One is Kevin Reynolds. To listen back to Confinements and for full music details, go to rte.ie/drama-on-one.
rte.ie/drama-on-one.
You're listening to Drama on One on the eve of International Holocaust Memorial Day and the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. In April 2016, Holocaust expert and Auschwitz guide Pavel Savitsky took Kevin Reynolds on a day-long tour through the biggest Nazi industrial killing factory, the murder camps of Auschwitz and Auschwitz II, Birkenau. This is an excerpt from Kevin's documentary, Auschwitz, An Echo Trapped Forever.
Lost people of Treblinka and Pompeii, save us, they seem to say, let the God not abandon us who have come so far in darkness and in pain.
Das Gepäck abstellen, nachher kommen sie wieder zusammen.
April is the cruelest month.
This is a room where you can see people's hope.
Breeding lilacs out of the dead land.
Since we're looking at thousands and thousands of different kitchenware items.
We too had our lives to live. You with your light meter and relaxed itinerary, let not our naive labors have been in vain.
You can see jars, you can see kettles, you can see bowls, you can see pans, frying pans, all kinds of things that people brought with them believing that this is resettlement.
We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the Hofgarten and drank coffee and talked for an hour. Bin gar keine Russin, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch.
Auschwitz był największym niemieckim nazistowskim obozem koncentracyjnym i zagłady. W latach 1940-1945
naziści... Nie wierzę, nie rozumiem.
Auschwitz was the largest Nazi German concentration camp and death camp. In the years 1940-1945, the Nazis deported at least 1.3 million people to Auschwitz. 1.1 million Jews.
Please wait, okay?
140,000-150,000 non-Jewish Poles, 23,000 Sinti and Roma, 15,000 Soviet prisoners of war, and 25,000 prisoners from other ethnic groups. 1.1 million of these people died in Auschwitz. Approximately 90% of them were Jews. The SS murdered the majority of them in the gas chambers.
In 2016, Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf fell out of copyright. A scholarly, annotated version was published in January 2016. The first print run sold out immediately. Within 12 months, Mein Kampf has been reprinted 6 times and has sold over 85,000 copies.
101 wartownia na OTEK.
Radio.
Zgłaszam 101.
Czy przyszedł już pan Sawicki do pracy, może? A tutaj nie ma pana Sawickiego, on czeka tutaj na niego. To z Irlandii. Pan z radia. Radio, yes?
Tak, mamy tu. To trzeba go pokierować do pana Sawickiego. Mamy tu, że ma przyjść do niego na siódmą.
Please go to the security gate I open for you. Please go with me. Security, please come in with me. We have got information about you. Okay.
Okay, this will be the day.
Do you have any sleep?
I do.
I'm entering Auschwitz-Birkenau Memorial Museum in Uschwim, Poland. I've arranged to meet Paweł Sawicki. He works as a guide in Auschwitz.
I got the train.
Where did you come from on this train?
Prague.
From Prague. Why didn't you fly to Poland?
I could have flown to Krakow and taken a bus. I thought that a solitary act of pilgrimage, travelling alone by train at night to bear witness, would infuse the experience with a sense of empathy and the dignity and decorum such a visit demands.
So we're standing right now in front of the main entrance to the camp. And this is one of the icons that people remember, that people know. The gate with the very famous inscription, Arbeit macht frei, work makes one free. Very cynical, if you think about the meaning, because you have survivors, and they say that when they arrived here, they had no idea where they were. And when they looked at the gate and the sign, work makes one free, they felt some hope that that it is some kind of a slave labor camp and they'll be able to work here and possibly leave this place. But after hours, after hours, they understood that this is a complete lie, this is cynicism, that people do not leave this place because they work well, that this is a concentration camp, place of terror, place of dehumanization, and a place of death. And, well, you can also notice one detail when you look at the gate, that the letter B in the word Arbeit is upside down. And there are stories linked with this letter B, that this is the first sign of resistance in a way. And survivors talk about this B. And for them, this seemingly insignificant detail of the camp architecture gave them some hope. Even with this little thing, this could keep them human beings, because when you think of the concentration camp, on one hand you have dehumanization, conditions of life, food, work conditions, terror system, punishments, everything was supposed to dehumanize people. But on the other hand, we have people, prisoners, who try everything to stay human beings here. So on the opposite side from the former SS hospital, you can see the grey building covered with earth, and on the other side of the building there's the chimney. Before the war, in the Polish army barracks, this was the munition storage room. When the SS turned it into a concentration camp, they turned it into a morgue. And next to the morgue, they built a crematorium. The first crematorium was here already in August 1940. It had one oven. Later, it had the second one and the third one, finally. And when in September 1941, Cyclone B was tested in Block 11, and the SS learned that it works, but they must find a different place to kill people, they decided to build the first gas chamber in the camp's morgue. So in autumn 1941, they fenced the whole morgue and crematorium off so that prisoners and also SS men and civilians who were nearby couldn't see what was going on. And this is where they start murdering people. They make holes in the ceiling in the morgue, and this is how Cyclone B could be dropped inside. People come into the yard, they undressed on the little yard in front of the entrance. From the roof of the gas chamber, SS spoke to them, promising them jobs and promising them disinfection, telling them that soup is being cooked for them, asking them about professions. And then people calmed down because they obviously didn't know what was going on, and they entered the room, and this is where they were killed. And because this building was very close to the camp and very close to the SS buildings, the SS wanted to avoid any shouts being heard from the outside. So when people were murdered here, they ran two trucks that drove around the building to create loud noise, to cover the noises of people who for a few minutes shouted in the gas chambers. And this is why in spring 1942 they decide to move the killing process from here, from Auschwitz I, because it was too close to the witnesses. They move it to the forest in Birkenau, and they build the whole extermination center over there, at first with two farmhouses turned into gas chambers, and finally in spring 1943 building four gas chambers and crematorias, industrial-like factories designed for this purpose. But this is where there are these two places in Auschwitz I, Block 11 and the first gas chamber, where the extermination starts.
There have been deaths, the pale flesh flaking into the earth that nourished it, and nightmares born of these and the grim dominion of stale air and rank moisture. Those nearest the door grow strong. Elbow room, elbow room.
We are entering a dark room, which is 20 meters long, and on the left-hand side you have the display along the whole room with the human hair. The hair which was cut from the heads of people murdered in gas chambers. And this hair after the war was also examined, and traces of hydrogen cyanide was found on this hair. So we know that it belonged to the murdered people. And then there are 2 tons of hair here, almost 2,000 kilograms. So you can estimate that they could belong to approximately even 40,000 people. So symbolically speaking here, you're looking at the small town which was murdered here in this camp. And we decided to display the hair because they are one of the most important evidence of the crime which took place here. But because we still want to keep the dignity of the people, we ask visitors, first of all, not to take pictures here. We keep the room dark, not only not to let sunlight in, but also to create this atmosphere that people come to a very important place where there should be quiet, where they should simply look and reflect. But also hair is the only item in the whole memorial today which we do not conserve. We decided that out of dignity, out of respect, we do not consider this human hair as another artifact of the museum. We let them disintegrate naturally, and there will be a time in the future, although we don't know when, that people will come here and they will not be able to see this important evidence of the murder of people.
Transport, deportation, selection, dusche.
So the camp, of course, was surrounded by barbed wire fence lines. And we can see the barbed wire. We can see double fence line of Auschwitz I, which protected the camp. Of course, it didn't allow prisoners to escape. But it is also the source of very tragic stories, since from the other side you can see that there are, first of all, two main lines of fences, but you can see a smaller, shortened line 5 meters away from here. So in front of the inside fence line. Prisoners were not allowed to cross that line at all. If they crossed that line, the guards who were on the watchtowers around the camp, or the guards who were passing by, were authorized to shoot the prisoner without any warning. So we know from testimonies that sometimes it was a way to kill a prisoner, to murder a prisoner. An SS man, a guard, took something that belonged to a prisoner, a tool, a hat, anything, threw it on the other side and gave the direct order to bring it back. And the prisoner didn't really have a choice. It was like a trap, because he either didn't listen to the direct order and could be punished or killed, or simply followed the orders and then the guards made the shot. But it was also a way to commit suicide in the camp. Those prisoners who couldn't cope, if they didn't have enough strength to harm themselves, because it's not always so easy, even if you're desperate, they had an easier way to cross that line, approach the fence lines, and wait for the guard to react. And there is another very tragic thing happening after those deaths, because every registered prisoner who was killed in the camp had to have a death certificate issued by the camp administration. In those documents you'll find, in the cases of prisoners who were either shot at the fences or those who committed suicide, that prisoners were shot during an escape attempt. And the guard who did it sometimes received some kind of a bonus or a vacation. And you can see that there is a forgery also taking place from the perpetrators lying about the causes of death of prisoners. Those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it.
They're begging us, you see, in their wordless way, to do something, to speak on their behalf, or at least not to close the door again. Lost people of Treblinka and Pompeii, save us, they seem to say. Let the God not abandon us, who have come so far in darkness and in pain. We too had our lives to live, you with your light meter and relaxed itinerary. Let not our naive labors have been in vain.
You've been listening to an excerpt of Auschwitz, An Echo Trapped Forever, a programme recorded in April 2016. The narrator was Holocaust expert and Auschwitz guide Pavel Savitsky. In the programme, you heard excerpts from A Disused Shed in County Wexford, written and read by Derek Mahon. The Wasteland Part 1, The Burial Ground, written and read by T.S. Eliot. And the music was Iconography by Max Richter. A Disused Shed in County Wexford by Derek Mahon is from his new collected poems and is published by the Gallery Press. The recording of Derek Mahon is from the Cladder record Open Air, Selected Poems, 1960 to 2005, and can be found on the Cladder Records website. Sound supervision was by Richard McCulloch. Auschwitz, An Echo Trapped Forever, was produced by Kevin Reynolds.
rte.ie/drama-on-1.
And we'll continue now with another radio piece for Holocaust Memorial Day. When Vanessa Redgrave visited RTE Radio in 2007 as a guest of Amnesty International, she recorded a public interview with John Kelly. You can hear that programme, An Evening with Vanessa Redgrave, on the Drama on One website. But at around 10:30 that night, after the interview, a quick cup of tea and a cigarette, Ms. Redgrave repaired to the Drama on One studio. This is Vanessa Redgrave performing 17 Trees by Jennifer Johnston.
Silence. Yes. Tears. Men, boys, girls, friends. These are some of the words in the glass box, there for you to read. 14th May 1944. That was the day, I think it was a Tuesday. 14th May 1944 is written on a big polished stone, carved in deep clefts of writing. It was a beautiful day, full of spring, full of green and bursting flowers. A great day for happiness. Our house gave directly onto the street. The door was open, and the sweet smells of spring crept into our rooms. At least I presume they did. I've no absolute recollection of such a thing. I was but five. I could skip. I remember that so well, the pride of my skipping. That morning, my mother had bought me a red rope of my own. "You must not skip in the house, Baba," she had said to me, and given me a little push towards the door. "Go on, out with you." Tap, 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 cross hands. Tap, tap, open arms. Cross once more. It was a sleepy kind of day. Distant cowbells. Laughter from a house across the road and the sound of the rope tapping on the ground and the bouncing of my feet. That is also why I whisper, so as not to disturb the sleepy peace of the place. I sleep now in the graveyard at the top of the town, on the right past the church, beside old Joe. Everyone called him Old Joe, and they called our son Young Joe and our grandson Joseph. He was one of the children who wrote words on pieces of paper and dropped them into the glass box by the side of the road. Bird. He wrote B-I-R-D. I know, because he showed it to me. He was so proud of that word. B-I-R-D. He had no help with writing it. B-I-R-D. It flew into the box as he opened his fingers. I stood and watched as each child dropped their words into the box. Flying birds. Then the mayor mixed them round with a stick and the children watched, and I stood there and watched them and thought of that spring day when I, like them, was also five. I was skipping and the sun sprinkled the ground with silver through the branches of the trees, and my friend Julie leaned from a bedroom window across the road and watched as I tapped and tapped, arms crossing and uncrossing, and I was happy to be watched by her. Tap, tap, and in the distance the sound of mosquitoes, wasps, bees, ants, flies, drone, drone, louder. My mother came to the door and stood there for a moment, a slight frown on her face. I wondered, had I done something wrong? I crossed my arms again. "Look, Mama," I called to her, "look at me." She put out her hand and took my shoulder, roughly. She wasn't usually rough with me. "Come," she said. She pulled me into the house and closed the door. She stood silently, her head bent, listening. The droning sound grew louder. Growl. Snarl. Anger. Her hand on my shoulder shook. I dropped my rope on the floor as she pulled me into the kitchen. The air was steamy and fragrant. A lorry whined past the door. Then motor bicycles. Such a noise they made, their engines revving. "Soldiers!" She whispered the word as if they might hear her through our door and walls. Soldier, sailor, beggarman, thief. Thief. The noise of the engines in the street stopped. A and we could hear the soldiers' feet slapping the roadways. Voices shouted orders, voices that I could not understand. I ran towards the door and wanted to see what they were doing, these soldiers. We had no soldiers in our village, no uniforms except for our policemen. She caught me by the arm. No. I want to see them. No. Her gripping fingers hurt my arm. No, no. There was the sound of a loudspeaker. Everyone in the village out into the square. Quick, run. Everyone out. My mother sighed. A loud, dolorous sound. A sound without end. I hear her sigh even now in the wind blowing through the trees, in the breath of the earth as it receives the rain. Sighs, moaning, silence. She opened the door and we went out into the street. Across the road, Julie and her mother mirrored our movements. Hand in hand, we moved towards the square. Soldiers lined the street. Hands, the whole village, holding hands. Mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, Julie, me, all moved with care. Grandmothers, grandfathers, the soldiers watched with care. Eyes watched, guns, helmets, boots. I know what terror is. It was in my mouth, in my head, in my belly, in my mother's hand that held mine. Suddenly the shouting started again and she pulled me towards her. She buried my face in her red skirt. She covered my ears with her hands. We stood quite still for what seemed like hours. My eyes itched and burned with the redness of her skirt. The lorry started up again. The motor bicycles revved and they left the village. Down the long hill, became once more mosquitoes. The sound was soon gone, bereft, mourning, sorrowful, gone forever. Auschwitz, Mauthausen were written on our stones in deep clefts of writing. The spring remained with us. The red skipping rope lay on the hall floor. Spring. Cowbells. Uncaring. Turned into summer. Autumn. Winter. 17 trees. High, healthy trees. One of them named for Julie. My friend, Julie. And in the spring, the sunshine sprinkles the ground with silver through the branches of the trees. 17 trees.
That was Vanessa Redgrave in 17 Trees by Jennifer Johnston. Sound supervision was by Philip Cook and Kevin Reynolds produced. Next week, we'll continue the theme with The Silent Passenger by Ronan Brady, tracking Freud's flight from Vienna at the height of Nazi reign. You can find all of tonight's programmes at rte.ie/drama on one.
rte.ie/drama on one.